can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
You watch the movies, slash flicks, slash tracks for the good, slash bad. It's the Slash Film Cast for the girls, slash boys, slash old, slash young. Yeah, we watch till the last of the credits is done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Film Cast. I'm David Chen, and joining me today is only one person, Jeff Cannata. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Good, Dave. You're back.
I'm so happy. I was so disappointed with your hosting job the last couple weeks. I'm like, dude, I got to redeem this thing. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. No, that was my goal. It was all a ploy to lure you back to the show, is just do it very poorly.
Seriously, though, Jeff did a great job, and I've just been super busy, my job at work, plus I've been sick again. You know, like, I've been dealing with, like, a bunch of things. I took a trip across the country to Virginia to show The Primary Instinct, the film I directed with Stephen Tobolowsky. A lot of stuff going on in the last couple weeks, and I'm so grateful to Jeff Cannata and Devendra and our awesome guests for stepping in and filling in for me the last few weeks on the Slash Filmcast. And, of course, this week... I am stepping in to fill in for Devendra Hardwar, because Devendra and his wife Raquel had a baby this week.
It's amazing, a beautiful baby, and we're wishing them all the best. And Devendra is taking some well-deserved time away to spend time with his new family.
Yeah, I mean, the baby photos that he posted are so cute. It's like I kind of disbelieve that baby could have somehow come from Devendra's DNA. You know what I mean?
It's true. It defies all logic.
It does. It does. But seriously, though, congratulations to Devendra and his wife Raquel. It sounds like both mom and baby are doing really well. And I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
New life. Another addition to the Slash Filmcast family. So cool.
And as several people on Twitter pointed out, now two of us will fully understand Interstellar.
That's correct. That's correct. And for those who don't get that, you know, like, I'm very, like, opposed to inside jokes on a podcast because I feel like they alienate newcomers. Like,
No. What they do is they reward loyal listenership.
There is somebody listening this week for the first time. And they have no idea what that reference means.
They should feel bad that they didn't find us sooner.
I will explain what that means, which is that a long time ago, after I gave a fairly negative review of Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, somebody wrote in and said that I could not possibly understand that film because I didn't have children. Mm-hmm. So ever since then, whenever we talk about children, we talk about the auxiliary benefit of having children, having a full understanding of Interstellar.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it was the only reason I actually had kids. I was like, I really want to get that movie.
That's my understanding. So,
yeah.
Anyway, again.
And then I was like, I really want to get that movie even more. And then I had a second one. I still don't get this movie.
Yeah.
Well, I better have a second kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just for safety.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And don't even get me started on what we had to do to understand Inception. anyway, again, congrats to Devendra and his wife. And I think he's going to take some time off, is my understanding. And hopefully he'll be back sometime in the next couple months, before the end of the year, probably, is my guess.
Yeah.
But
and you kind of glossed over it, Dave, but I also want to say congratulations on your screening of The Primary Instinct, and I thoroughly enjoyed your video. You made a sort of a video blog about the experience with Steven, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. So people should check that out if they haven't already.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, at youtube.com/DaveChensky, that's Dave Chen SKY, you can check out my video blog about it. And it's just such a rare privilege to be able to screen a movie that you've made in front of people who are eager to watch it. And so I just wanted to be able to capture that excitement. And so I tried to do that. I actually used my new iPhone XS Max to try vlogging it to see how it would look and sound.
Looked
so
good.
If you're curious about it, you can go check that out. On my YouTube page. Anyway, So wanted to make those announcements, but I am back in Seattle. I have a cough, so I might cough occasionally, but I'll try to mute the microphone when that happens. But in the meantime, you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And probably going to be a pretty short episode today. We're just going to talk about some what we've been watching and then move on into an in-depth review. This week, we're going to be reviewing Halloween, the reboot, remake, requel.
Of Halloween.
Sidequel, legacy-quel.
The Halloween happened. This Halloween happened after Halloween. So you have to watch Halloween before you watch Halloween. Don't make the mistake of watching Halloween before Halloween, because Halloween comes after Halloween. So,
well, you're forgetting that there is a third Halloween that was released between Halloween and Halloween.
Right, but Halloween doesn't acknowledge that Halloween exists. It only references Halloween and not Halloween.
Oh, right. It only references Halloween.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, no, you're right. Good point.
Somebody on Twitter who I promised I would remember their name and I have forgotten now. Came up with, I think, a brilliant nomenclature, and you know who you are. He said that we should be calling it Halloween, Halloween-ween, and Halloween-ween-ween. That way, no confusion will happen when you're talking about how Halloween-ween-ween references Halloween, but it does not reference Halloween-ween.
I mean, I think when the Fast and Furious movies came out with their naming scheme, we thought, like, this is as low as it gets when it comes to franchise naming. And I think Halloween has proved us all wrong, right?
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah.
Well, before we get to what we've been watching this week, I wanted to do something that some might consider this fun. Some might consider it amusing. Others might consider it a colossal waste of time meant to pad out the runtime of the show. But we're going to find out momentarily. As some of you may know, we have a massive group, a Slack group of over 2,000 members.
It's called phenomenal group. I lurk often and I post rarely, but I do enjoy it consistently.
So it is called the Slack Filmcast. You can join at slackfilmcast.com. And there is a member of that group, Patrick S., who goes by username PSIM, P-S-I-M. And what he's been doing is he has been going through the entire history of the Slash Filmcast. And he has been taking notes on all the old episodes, right? And like, we used to do film news on the podcast, but we don't really do that anymore. That is more the realm of Slash Film Daily, which is another podcast that's part of Slash Film that I'd recommend. You can subscribe to that at daily.slashfilm.com. And so we've kind of offloaded most of our news to that podcast, and they do a much better job than we would on this show. But we used to cover news on the Slash Filmcast. And so it's fascinating to go back to, you know, we're at episode 490 right now, but to go back 400 episodes and to think about what was happening like 8 years ago on the Slash Filmcast. And so I just wanted to read some of these entries that Patrick S. had written. Like, he took notes about what was happening. Okay, so I'm going to read this. There's some editorializing on some of these entries, and that's all coming from Patrick, so it's not coming from me, right? Okay, so here we go. So we used to actually sometimes still do record these things called the Slash Filmcast After Dark, where we kind of riff around about a bunch of random things. But I used to do that every week. We used to record a Slash Filmcast After Dark every week. And of course, that became way too much. But
this is before my time, so I'm only mildly interested. But I find these fascinating because, as you'll find, dear listener, Dave and Devendra did not hesitate to make predictions based on news.
That is correct.
And here we are in their future.
Yes.
To be able to determine how accurate or inaccurate their prostidigitation. No, that's not the word I want. Their
prognostication
was, yeah. Yes.
I mean, I was not always a three-time summer movie wager winning person. So, So some of this might be inaccurate. But here we go. Patrick S. writes, episode 103, After Dark, Tony Jaa to retire from acting in order to become a monk. Apparently, he really became one before returning a couple of years later. Episode 104, a movie about Lev Grossman, the Tom Cruise character from Tropic Thunder, is announced. kind of glad that never happened. Episode 111. Talking about the announcement for X-Men First Class, they speak about superhero fatigue and how Avengers will probably be the last big one for a while.
Nailed that one, guys.
Nailed it. Episode 113. J.J. Abrams is developing a movie based on the game 7 Minutes in Heaven. Huge bummer that one never came to pass.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I think that was adapted into 10 Cloverfield Lane is my answer. Episode 114.
Several Months in Heaven. It was that not the original title.
Episode 114. Blockbuster is entering bankruptcy with the goal to close a few hundred stores of their several thousand stores in order to emerge even leaner and meaner.
Shrewd, Blockbuster. Shrewd.
Good.
They're gonna emerge any day now, Dave.
It's still anyone's game, is my understanding.
Merely the fact that you guys were doing this show while there was still Blockbusters is a remarkable thing.
Indeed, indeed. Episode 115. M. Night Shyamalan announces that the third film in his Night Chronicles will be based on a character that he cut from Unbreakable and will be a standalone sequel.
Wow.
So
It was all there.
Not going to say whether that one has come to pass, but the answer is maybe.
It was all there. We just had to put it together.
Maybe it's already happened. Okay, episode 119. David O. Russell confirmed for the Uncharted movie adaptation.
Yeah.
Which still has
You've had three or four directors confirmed for Uncharted.
I mean, didn't Nathan Fillion do the Uncharted like short film at some point?
Yeah, I mean, that was a fan film. It wasn't...
I don't think we're ever... Prediction today, I don't think we're ever going to see a major release Uncharted film.
No, right? Isn't Todd Holland doing the young Uncharted movie right now? They repped on Spider-Man, isn't his, that his
Tom
next thing?
Tom Holland?
What did I say?
You said Todd Holland, I think.
Yeah, his brother.
His brother. Tom Holland's brother, Todd Holland. I don't know. We'll see. But I just Jeff, we've been talking about the Uncharted movie for 8 years. So
yeah,
the idea that it's finally going to come to fruition, mark my words, everyone, we're never going to see an Uncharted film. No, who knows? That might happen. Okay. Episode 120. Marvel is developing a live-action Hulk series. Whatever happened to that?
Hmm.
Guests. Patrick writes some guests that occurred. The first appearance of Armand White happened in episode 109. Wow. Armand White did not like the film.
What?
But that was a legendary episode, in my opinion. Like,
which movie was it?
Inception, the Christopher Nolan film.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people felt like we were intellectually outmatched by Armand White on that episode. That Armand...
Well, low bar.
Successfully, thanks, Jeff. Successfully defeated us on that episode, which you know is. I still really appreciated the fact that he joined the podcast. So, episode 112, Jeff Cannata appears on the show, not his first appearance, but maybe the second. For the After Dark, Adam couldn't stay around, and they talk about avoiding spoilers from movie trailers and have a discussion about movie theater etiquette. It's basically a 2018 episode.
I have one note. Evidently, I have. I talk about one thing for the last.
I mean,
decade.
I try to tell you that, Jeff, but you don't listen. A few other things. Episode 105, After Dark. Dave and Adam discuss why they've started to avoid watching and analyzing movie trailers. Episode 107, After Dark. Dave discussing Avatar: The Last Airbender, and then Patrick quotes me. He says, "When is going to be the next tentpole release where there's actually an opportunity for Asian actors to play all the lead roles? It could be a decade." End quote.
Wow.
Close enough. Close enough, unfortunately. Yeah. And then episode 109, summer of 2010, is dubbed the summer of disappointing sequels and remakes.
And every summer afterwards.
It would be the first of many. So yeah. I think, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And a big thanks to Patrick for chronicling all that. I just thought it was totally fascinating, right?
It's awesome. And Patrick is awesome for doing that, for taking the time not only to listen to all those episodes, but to take notes and share them with everyone. As the show approaches episode 500, which is just around the corner, it's pretty amazing to kind of have this look back, because you know what? We weren't going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Indeed. Right? Okay. So let's get to what we've been watching this week. And Jeff, I've been watching so much stuff in the last couple weeks.
Take it away. I'm excited to hear.
But here's the thing, Jeff. I was thinking, hey, I'm going to be back on the Slash Filmcast this week. I've watched a ton of stuff, but I don't want to just come on the show and talk about all the stuff. Because like, you guys have spent the last few weeks delivering full, in-depth, spoiler-filled reviews about all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And like, why would I want to step on your toes and rain on your parade, blah, blah, blah? You know, like I want to.
You got to take it up a notch.
So I had this idea of like, rather than talk about every single thing I watched in depth, why don't I summarize what I watched in limerick form? You know,
limerick form.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it because you watched everything in Nantucket?
No, it's not. That's not the reason. It's because I thought, hey, this is a brief, witty way. Mm. To communicate what I've watched, and also hopefully it'll be like amusing, you know, be like really amusing to like hear it rather than like hearing me drone on about all the stuff you guys have talked about. But Jeff, I've learned a couple things while writing limericks for the things I've watched.
Okay,
one of them is it's really hard to write good limericks, and right. The other thing is I am not good at writing good limericks.
Oh, this crushes me because I was about to pitch to you, David, a new policy where we have to write a limerick every week. I think we should be the show that has limericks. And I am so excited about this idea that I think, you know, we have recently been accepted into Rotten Tomatoes. And I think our Rotten Tomatoes submission should be a limerick.
Mm.
Well, I think that would be brilliant and genius.
Let's talk about that offline, as they say in meetings at my office sometimes. Let's talk about that offline.
But I do like the idea that we do our reviews, and then at the end of our reviews, we have to then summarize them in a limerick that we have written.
That's a terrible idea. Like limerick, you really need to like write them out in advance. You can't just extemporize limericks.
No. I'm saying you talk about all the things you talk about, and then you end with saying the limerick that you have prepared in advance.
Okay. Well,
I like this idea, Dave. It's your idea.
No, it's really not, Jeff. You're really taking things and running with them to an inappropriate degree. But here,
I love your idea.
So these limericks were bad. Like I really wanted them to be good. I really wanted you to listen to the limerick and be like, oh, that tickled me. That tickled me. That limerick just tickled me.
Right.
Not only did I learn a lot about a movie, but I'm also impressed by Dave's wit and verve.
Mm-hmm.
And
his command of the language.
My command of English, my mastery of the form. Mm-hmm. And that none of that happened when I was writing these limericks. So I don't want to just discard them. You know, that would be a waste, right?
Do you understand how I'm even more excited now?
Yeah, no, I understand that. So why don't I give these a shot? I'll read the limericks, okay?
Yeah.
And maybe you can by letter grade or some way of showing like what you think of the limerick, you know? Thumbs up, thumbs down, like letter grade, however you feel appropriate. Okay, here we go.
I love it. Are you going to tell me what the movie or TV show is beforehand?
You know, I was thinking about that. Like, I was thinking, like, maybe you should guess it, but, like, it's really obvious what it is.
Okay.
So I don't think that's going to be fun. So I'm just going to tell you what it is before I say it, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Venom. Okay?
Mm, yeah.
Sony used to make hit after hit, but this film is totally shit. The plot's a disaster, but nonetheless hereafter, there'll be sequels we shouldn't permit.
Hey, that's not bad. That's a solid B, dude.
B. Thanks. Yeah. I appreciate that. Okay.
I mean, I'm sad you didn't work in, you know, some more specific language to the movie. You know, the word tongue would be a fun thing to rhyme, I think.
The quote, I'm sorry about Venom, you know, is
it's good.
It's definitely
good.
Essential.
But I think it's a solid B.
Yeah, that movie was terrible.
You didn't find any. I found some fun with it, as I said on our show.
It is redeemed by Tom Hardy's insane performance.
Yeah.
So
I agree. Yeah.
Okay. See, watching Tom Hardy get into a lobster tank.
Right.
Worth the price of admission. Worth the price of admission. That's right. That's right. If Tom Hardy was not in the movie, there would be absolutely nothing to recommend that movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. Okay.
Did you hear? Did you listen to our episode? I said I liked that movie better when it was called The Mask.
Mm, nice. Good. Yeah. Good reference.
Yeah.
A Star Is Born.
Mm.
A great voice Lady Gaga has got, but her love for Bradley Cooper is for naught. They both have great takes, musical takes, in this middling remake that updates the songs but not the plot.
Okay. All right. I'm going to give you a C on that one.
C? Yeah. Okay. That's deserved.
Yeah. I mean, average. C is average. I think you're going for easy rhymes, Dave. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
No, I think you're right about that. I think that's that's a fair assessment.
Yeah.
Okay. First Man. Ryan Gosling is going to space with lots of shaky cam close on his face.
Mm-hmm.
People died along the way. Such a high price to pay. But in my book, this film gets an ace.
Oh, see, that's the best one yet.
Here's
I like
a problem.
That one.
Here's a problem, though. Like, in my opinion, the movie is only like a B, B plus. But I was so far into the limerick at that point. I couldn't turn the bus around.
Couldn't you just say the movie gets just below an ace?
I couldn't figure out anything that rhymes with B, you know?
Well, now I have to deduct you some points for being just dishonest at this point.
That's, yeah, I mean,
just pure dishonesty.
That's brutal. That's brutal what you're doing. But no, I thought, you know, First Man is my least favorite of Damien Chazelle's movies.
Mm.
Like, it's the one I'm probably gonna go back and rewatch the least. But it does recontextualize the entire space race in a way that, you know, when you read about it in elementary school, it's like, oh, we conquered the moon, da 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 da, and it's like you forget A, how freaking uncertain it was that we'd ever do that,
right?
And B, the incredibly high cost of all these lives that were lost along the way. And it makes, you know, space flight to be terrifying. It makes it out to be like a horrific, harrowing process.
Which undoubtedly was. And we lose sight of that. And kudos to sort of recapturing that aspect of it. But I agree with you that it is my least favorite of those films, of his films.
Damien Chazelle is 33 years old. He was born in 1985. His last two films were nominated for Best Picture, and it looks like this one will be as well. So this guy is the real deal, you know?
And his last movie won and then didn't, but won for like a few minutes.
Yeah, for more like 30 seconds. But I think what is also amazing is how different this movie is than his last two films.
That, I think, is also really, really cool. I love it when a filmmaker just shows wide range like that. I mean, it not only is the subject matter wildly different and the tone wildly different, but how he chose to shoot it.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like the same filmmaker. It's really cool.
You watch La La Land and you watch this movie, and I think it'd be very difficult for you to say these two films were made by the same person, right?
Yeah.
And that might be actually off-putting for some people. Like, I think the shaky cam is really intense and does lead to kind of a samey feeling for the film after a while. But, it all feels extremely deliberate. It doesn't feel like he did that by accident or that it was bad filmmaking. Like, he wanted to convey a very subjective experience in this film, right?
Yes.
So, anyway, First Man, it's pretty good. Oh, I will say, though, that after reading an article by a fellow critic saying you should definitely watch this movie in IMAX, I moved to heaven and earth. Not moved to heaven and earth, but like I made some efforts to watch this movie on a true IMAX screen.
Yeah. You didn't think it was worth it?
No, I didn't think it was worth it.
Oh, the moment where you go into full IMAX, I thought, like we were saying with getting into a lobster tank with Venom, is worth the price of admission. I thought that just that the way it's used, I've never seen IMAX used like that before.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is the best presentation of the film, so you should see it in true IMAX if you can. But I wouldn't, like, break an appointment, you know what I mean, to go see it in true IMAX. Like, because it's so short. It's like 3 minutes, 5 minutes in true IMAX, you know what I mean? And, yeah, I agree that it is very, like, intentional and very, like, I understand the impact it's going for, but it just didn't work on me, unfortunately. I don't know. Just my opinion. I feel like when I go see a movie in true IMAX, I really wanted to deliver on that promise.
Yeah.
And for me, the amount of footage, just like sheer quantity of footage in true IMAX did not make it feel worth it. And if you go to see it at like an AMC Limax, for instance, you're still getting a larger image, right, than you would otherwise. So it's not like true IMAX aspect ratio, but it's still like somewhat bigger. And I think for most people, that's going to be completely adequate. But that's me. That's me. Okay. Final limerick. This one is the one I'm least proud of.
Okay.
This is Bad Times at the El Royale. Some strangers get lost in a hotel. Their chemistry allows them to gel. Great acting and singing meant everyone was bringing their A game to this film. That bodes well.
Oh, Dave. Oh, Dave. It wasn't so bad until the last sentence.
I know, I know. Like, it really goes downhill, that last sentence, right?
It really does.
It really does.
It does not finish strong. Yeah.
But I really loved Bad Times at the El Royale.
It's great. Yeah.
I thought it was great. And, you know, people are like, oh, it's too long. I've seen like numerous articles say it's too long. 2 hours and 20 minutes too long. Guys, film length does not actually matter. I mean, I know I just contradicted what I'm saying right now with my IMAX review of First Man. But film length does not matter as long as you are engrossed in the story. And I was completely engrossed. I love – it's such a lavish production. It feels like so like the production design and every aspect of the production feels so meticulously considered. And all the acting is great. You have some amazing performances and the breakout star of the film – they took a – I think that's her first acting credit, right? The woman who plays Cynthia?
My understanding is that she's a Broadway musical star.
Right. Cynthia Erivo, right? Mm-hmm. She's looking over her IMDb. She's been in a few things. This is like – actually, the other film that she's been in is Widows, which is not coming out until next month. But yeah, so this is like, I guess, her first major wide release. And she's amazing. She plays Darlene Sweet. And she's basically the protagonist of the movie. Like the movie begins on her and follows her for a lot of the runtime. And I think she's amazing, you know. It's a bold move to base your entire film on a person that has very few film credits. But I think it paid off very well in this movie. So... I really love this movie. I don't know why some people are down on it, but had a great time. I actually would be up for watching it again in theaters. How engrossing it was.
I feel like you'd get more out of it knowing what happens. You know, it is one of those movies that unspools in front of you, and you kind of – you're bewildered for quite a while. And once you figure out who everyone is and what their true motives are, I think second viewing would be really interesting to see that all present before you knew it was present.
Indeed, indeed. So those are my limericks, Chef. What did you think of that last one?
I think that last one is a D minus.
Wow, D minus. I was hoping like D plus at least.
No.
No. Okay.
See me after class.
I love when the teacher just wrote like circled something in red and said like "see me" in red. That's like the worst.
It is the worst.
That's what you just gave me for that limerick.
I also kind of I deduct points because you should have had the sense to reorder your limericks so that they improved in quality over time. So that I would have been pleasantly surprised at your last one, and you really did leave the worst for last.
Okay.
So,
well, nothing you're saying is unfair. So
I do think you should seriously consider this being the limerick podcast. I think our audience will cry out in support of this idea. And
they're going to cry out, Jeff, but I don't think it's going to be in support.
I think finishing every review with a limerick is what we were born to do. And I say that knowing full well Devendra is not here to tell me no, but I think it's what we were born to do.
So my wife actually wrote a delightful limerick. She knew I was going to unleash these terrible limericks on the podcast today. And she actually wrote me a limerick to commemorate my return to the podcast. Here it is, Jeff. It's: one time David took a break, podcasts he decided not to make, but though he thrived, Devendra's baby arrived, so he's back to giving hot takes.
See, she knows how to write a limerick.
Mm.
That's so you save that fun rhyme for the end. You get the hot takes there. It's the fun rhyme at the end. It's the best one that you've read so far. So
I mean, again, I resent the implication of everything you're saying right now, but you know. Yeah,
she outclasses you yet again.
Okay. I mean, it's true. It's a true statement, but let's not get too out of control with that sentence.
I like how also if you read that limerick carefully, you sense that she's not too happy you're back.
that is completely correct. So anyway, let's move on with the show. So what else have I been watching? There's a couple things I've been watching that I didn't write limericks for. And I want to give a big shout out to The Night Comes for Us. This is a movie that is on Netflix, is written and directed by Timo Jahanto, who, as far as I understand, is a Slash Filmcast listener. Oh. This is what I have been told. Timo Jahanto
not
is
anymore.
A Slash Filmcast listener.
Not after the
not
limerick.
After that limerick assault. So his last movie was Headshot with Iko Uwe, you know, the main actor from the Raid films.
Right.
And he's made this movie, The Night Comes for Us, and this movie is insane. It is it's first of all, it's my favorite film of his so far. And the reason it's my favorite film is the violence. It's basically I don't know that the plot is that engaging, in my opinion. Like it's not like a super inventive plot. It's more of a set piece delivery mechanism. And the movie is nonstop set pieces. I would say the movie is what, like an hour and 50 minutes. Of the hour and 50 minutes, probably 90 minutes is action scenes, right? Like that's my kind of rough guesstimate of how much of the runtime is action. It's like, you know, well over 70-80%. And the action scenes are incredible. Like they are extremely gory. It's like human bodies absorbing incredible amounts of damage and still like going on to fight people. The fights are bloody. Like you see bones being broken. You see like hooks and like other sharp objects like penetrating and going through body parts. And a lot of it is done practically. And honestly, this reminds me of like when I was watching John. It made me feel like how I felt when I was watching John Woo's movies when I was a kid, you know, watching something like Hard Boiled or The Killer and all this over the top violence that's done so stylistically, that's so over the top, that's so impressive, like, and that creates these characters that become so memorable and iconic that I am just so impressed with this film and would recommend it if you are a fan of, you know, action movies, of martial arts films. And like want to see like something old school that's done with practical effects where like you just have a bad feeling that people got injured while they were making it, but they're probably fine. That's The Night Comes for Us. Wow. And, I'd highly recommend it. Were you a fan of those like kind of like cheesy, you know, action films when you're growing up?
Oh, yeah,
Nata?
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, that was like in my dorm room in college. That was like Friday night. We would, you know, put on a Jackie Chan movie or, you know, Hard Boiled or something we'd find at, you know, the video store when they were video stores. And we would, you know, investigate some crazy thing based on the back cover that looked like it was insane and nuts and ultra violent. And that, you know, I love that kind of stuff. I'm very curious to see this movie.
Yeah. It's like Jackie Chan movie, but without the humor and with far more gore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Jackie Chan's like always a funny guy. He's always, he's perpetually amazed that he's in the situations he's in.
Oh, yeah. It's a delight to watch that.
Delight is not the word I use to describe The Night Comes for Us. You know, like, no one is, like, really excited to be in the – or, like, amazed to be – like, they're all just, like, brutally maiming people left and right, you know?
Well, it sounds maybe like The Raid, you know, movies that I very much enjoyed where it's just, like, how did the stunt people not all end up – incapable of walking after making this.
And even that is like you know the fact that they were able to film this and like no one died is impressive,
right?
So anyway, it's The Night Comes for Us. Really memorable characters, really amazing action. And it's just brutal. Like, Jeff, I've been watching these movies my whole life. My whole life I've been watching action movies. This is a movie that I'm going to admit, I had to pause it and like take a break because it was so relentless. Oh. And so but brutal.
In a good way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for some people, they're like, that sounds terrible, David. Why would I ever want to watch that? For me, it's like, I'm just impressed at the audacity of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, The Night Comes Short is on Netflix right now. And speaking of shows on Netflix, I also had a chance to watch Making a Murderer Season 2, Episode 1 and 2. Haven't watched the whole thing. I just want to give a shout-out to this show because, like, so rare – like, most of the time when you watch a true crime series or listen to a true crime podcast like Serial or The Jinx, the documentarian, like, tears through these people's lives like a tornado and they never look back. And the documentarian becomes famous, but, like, the people who, like, lived through the ordeal they still have to live through the ordeal. Like, they're still living with the aftermath of that. And this is one of the first shows I've seen that actually acknowledges that. You know, like, the opening montage of Making Murder Season 2 is just, like, a summary of all the stuff that happened after the movie was released. Hmm. And I thought that it was, like, a montage of all these news clips. And I thought that was, like, pretty interesting, pretty impressive to see filmmakers – not they're, I would not describe these filmmakers as even-handed, but they at least acknowledge that – people have criticized their methods and that like that some people have been hurt by this film series. I thought that was like very interesting. We just rarely see documentarians grappling with the impact of their work. And so the show is mainly about like all the stuff that happened since the first season aired a few years ago. And I don't know if I'm going to make it through the whole thing. But I'm intrigued so far, and I just thought that was there was an impressive montage at the beginning of season two. So that's Making a Murder Season 2. We reviewed it on the Making a Murder Season 1 on the podcast.
Yeah, and I loved the first one. I was riveted by it, but yeah. I have been very torn as to whether or not I'm going to watch the second one because I don't know if I can put myself through that again. And because it was a different time when I saw that first season.
It was during the Obama era, right?
And the world has changed and things seem so much darker and I could sort of rally my own, I don't know, indignation and sense of justice around this story. And while I still think it deserves attention and as all stories of potential injustice do, I feel like I'm tapped out. It just I don't know if my constitution can endure another going through the emotional ringer of something like this. Yeah, you know,
well, I don't know if the U.S. Constitution can endure.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, but
boom.
But, I understand. You're saying like you're saying, hey, you your attention has been diverted in like 50 different directions in the last few years, and. And it's hard to get like you, Jeff Cannata, are perpetually worked up, and it's hard to get like worked up over an additional thing. And I understand.
I mean, and the first season was very much about potential abuse of power and the taking advantage of a social, you know, a certain socioeconomic group, people that live in a certain class system, and how the elements of power can work against them in very unfair ways. And that's just like headline news now. That's just day to day what's happening. That's just the levers of power are disenfranchising and destroying the lives of countless groups that are vulnerable. And it just feels like I don't have the capacity to endure this as a entertainment medium anymore, you know?
Fair enough, man. Fair enough. Well, that's Making a Murder Season 2. And you watch something like Making a Murder Season 2 despite that, right?
Yeah, I say all that, and I'm going to expose – after hearing so many people, including you and Devendra on this podcast, talk about American Vandal, I finally revisited it. I had actually watched, I don't know, 5 minutes of the first episode once. Just I turned it on like, what is this? Watched 5 minutes. I'm like, this looks dumb. I'm out. This looks like a sketch that was stupid.
Agreed.
And I'm out. And then I had heard from numerous folks, including you guys, that it is excellent and I should revisit. And so I did, and it is another one of those examples of I am glad I listened to you guys, and I'm glad that I gave it a second chance, because it's genius. That show is genius. I am absolutely floored by the fact that not only do they nail the structure and tone of the how to, you know, of Making a Murderer or Serial or those any of those self-serious investigative journalism pseudo documentaries, they nail the tone, they nail the structure, but they also create a legitimate mystery that is actually interesting while also being ridiculous and absurd, and but sort of has its own internal logic that makes a lot of sense. The motivations of these characters that they've written, that they've invented, that are caricatures of people that you knew in high school, that people know in high school now, teachers you've met. These are all – they're dealing with tropes that are familiar, but all of the motivations of those characters make sense. The thing that the best of those real shows do, which is – you think one way and then, oh, no, I think the exact opposite now. Oh, no, I think the exact opposite now. This show manages to do with its fiction all the while being ridiculous and funny and maintaining a level of verisimilitude in the performances that never pull me out. You know, it's very difficult to create this sort of faux cinema verite style and not make it seem too over the top or make it seem that they're obviously acting and obviously being ridiculous. All the performances are really grounded and feel really real and yet are super funny. I am so amazed that this works not just as a 5-minute sketch or one 30-minute episode, but it works as a full season of television. Like over and over and over again, it completely surprised me and impressed me with just the quality level of what they attempted to do, the audacity of just trying to do a parody of this and then pulling it off. It's very amazing to me.
I agree. It's really so. How much did you watch? Did you finish season one?
I have not quite finished season one yet. I was hoping to do that before I talked about it, but I have not yet.
Okay, so you don't know who drew the dicks yet?
I don't know who drew the dicks, okay. But I have some theories. But there are episodes that I have completely been – like the episode where they, you know, they
– have you gotten to like the party reconstruction episode yet?
Yes.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
Yes. Just writing that, plotting that out, and then shooting it must have been hard too, because you need all those pieces and you need everybody – you sort of need to plan it out like a play.
Because
everybody has to be in the right places from all the different perspectives, and you have to have that timeline correct. It's amazing. I love the episode where they treat each other, the two filmmaker kids treat each other as suspects. Mm-hmm. I thought that was awesome. They do everything that those shows do. They treat all the people the way the people are treated in those shows. The conversations that they record of themselves debating it, you know, like talking back and forth, presenting the evidence to each other and debating it back and forth. It's like it's all so perfect. And yet, the very young actors, not anybody you would know before this. And they're all so, I think, so real and grounded. The guy who plays sort of the main suspect is fantastic. Like he's like the casting of this show is so perfect. Everybody is exactly central casting for what you remember of that kind of person in high school, you know, or that kind of teacher in high school. They nailed it, and the performances are great too. So it's great.
Somebody wrote on Twitter, I don't remember who, I read this at some point months ago, but someone said like, this is the best depiction of high school since Freaks and Geeks, which I thought it was pretty – like you don't think about it like that because it's not a narrative fiction series, but
right.
Or it's not told that way. But I think it's very true. Like it totally nails high school, the experience of high school in my opinion. I think it's brilliant. And you were saying how like the faux documentary style doesn't bother you. And I think I was reading an interview with the guy who directed every episode, Tony Yacenda, I think his name is.
Yeah.
And he was saying what was really important to him was if you ever watch a mockumentary, like if you ever watch Christopher Guest stuff, virtually every interview, like talking head interview that's in those documentaries, it has a very similar structure. It's almost like a sitcom, right? It's almost like setup, punchline, cut right. to like B-roll. You know, like that's
right.
that's how a lot of those mockumentaries function. But that's not how real documentaries function, right? Like that, there's musings and ruminations that don't go anywhere or lead somewhere where you don't think in yeah. a real doc. And he very much wanted it to be played completely straight. And like no winking at the camera, no one even thinking that this is funny in any way that they're doing this. And I think that really works. That be, like the more straight they play it, the more funny it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
So, yeah.
Totally. And the episode, and I hope this isn't considered a spoiler. I don't think it is. But the episode that I was trying to remember that I thought was so genius is the one where as they sort of the show itself becomes famous and people have their own theories. And so they like go back and look at all the theories that viewers of their series are saying, you know, like it's so cool the way they step through all of those theories. It's exactly like when I was listening to Serial in real time and a new episode would come out and, you know, they'd be like, last week, everybody thought, you know, Adnan Syed was doing this and we checked that out. It's like, it is so, it understands all of the tropes of those things. And it acknowledges them and does them all so well. I'm astounded at the imagination to create all of the elements that needed to be created to pull off an actual interesting mystery. You know, they created a mystery, and that's not easy to do.
Indeed. Well, that's American Vandal Season 1. It's on Netflix right now, and Jeff Cannata has come around to it, and I'd recommend you come around as well. It's a great series. I watched season 2 in like 2 days. I love this show. I hope they keep making them for a really long time, as long as the show can be good.
I'm excited for season 2 for sure.
Yeah. That is what we've been watching this week. Before we get to our review of Halloween, we want to thank all the people who donated to the show this week. A big thanks to Siron Norris for his very generous contribution. And thanks to new monthly subscriber Noah Wentz, who's donating a little bit over $2 per month. You can do that if you want. If you want to help us defray the cost of seeing movies and putting on the show, you can always go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. We really appreciate any money you can throw our way. Thanks to all our donors and subscribers this week. You're awesome. Let's get to our review of Halloween.
We're here to investigate patient that killed 3 innocent teenagers on a Halloween in 1978. He was shot by his own psychiatrist and taken into custody that night, and has spent the last 40 years in captivity. Hello, Michael. I have something you might like to see.
Everyone in my family like turns into a nutcase this time of year. Yeah, I mean, your grandmother is Laurie Strode. She was almost murdered.
Wasn't it her brother who murdered all those babysitters?
No, it was not her brother. That's something that people made up.
Do you know that I pray every night that he would escape?
What the hell did you do that for?
So I can kill him.
That was from the trailer for Halloween, the new film by David Gordon Green. And I want to ask you a question, Jeff. Like, I have no idea what your relationship to these Halloween movies is. So, like, are you a fan of Halloween? Have you seen the movies before? Like, what's your deal?
I would not consider myself a fan of Halloween per se. It's not one of those ones that lodged itself in my psyche as a kid, or it wasn't a franchise that I fell in love with. Certainly my favorite horror franchise has always been Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm.
But I of course had seen Halloween, was aware of it, had seen several of the sequels. I doubt that I've seen all of the sequels, but I I'd have to go back and look. I wish I intended to do this, and I kick myself for not having done it. I wish I had rewatched the first one before watching this one, because I feel like I would have been rewarded.
So there have been 11 Halloween films, including this one, right? The first one coming out 40 years ago in 1978. How many of those movies do you think you've seen?
5 or 6.
Oh, wow. Nice. You know how many I'd seen before last week, Jeff? Zero. Had not even watched the original before. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
This is just a franchise that I had absolutely no interest in. And I'm not like not a fan of horror. I like you said, I also enjoy Nightmare on Elm Street. That's probably my favorite franchise of horror films. And even Friday the 13th, I've watched a few of them. But for some reason, like the idea of Michael Myers was just never particularly interesting to me. And so, I like the design, you know, like the design of the mask and the costume and everything like that.
That was a James T. Kirk mask.
Yeah, no, right? That's right. The original.
William Shatner.
The original.
Yeah.
And so I liked it. I liked the visual of it, but I never was particularly taken by the franchise. So people listening should just understand the perspective on this new film is coming from someone who just really had very little interest in the franchise. And I did buy the Blu-ray for the original Halloween film, and I did watch the Blu-ray for the original Halloween film, because this new Halloween film does away with completely ignores everything after the second film.
Right.
Or starting with the second film.
Did you watch it before you had seen this or after?
No, I watched the first 1978 film, then I watched this film.
Oh, good. And yeah, I wish I had rewatched that one before seeing this one.
Yeah, yeah. I also watched Screen Junkies did a Cram It video that was extremely amusing and helpful. It was like a 20-minute summary of every single Halloween film. And I would just recommend like that for people who are interested in catching up with all the Halloween films, because apparently we didn't really miss that much. That was my takeaway after watching that Kramit video. I mean, this franchise has gone in some crazy directions. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch doesn't even have to do with Michael Myers. Like, they tried to make this like an anthology series. Do you know about
that? Well, I was aware of that, but I think that in the age of Marvel universe tying things together and stuff mattering from film to film. And, you know, I know there have been movies that have maintained an internal structure, but it is very rare before Marvel pulled it off that anything that got beyond three movies made any damn sense whatsoever, you know? And almost always, if you had a franchise that got into the 6th, 7th, 8th installment, they just ignored things or became standalone. Before the era we're in now, that's just not something that people cared much about. Did it carry over from the previous one? No, it's got a new Halloween, which is a shorthand for who the bad guy is going to be, and there's going to be some stuff that happens that's negative. You know, that it's just a shorthand to tell you kind of what's going to happen. Not the fact that like the events of previous films matter for this one. It's just a new phenomenon and one I think has improved our viewing experiences. But these movies didn't care about that previously.
So here's the IMDb summary of the new film. Laurie Strode comes to her final confrontation with Michael Myers, the masked figure who has haunted her since she narrowly escaped his killing spree on Halloween night 4 decades ago. Jeff Cannata, what did you think of this film?
I was pretty impressed with it. I actually thought for what it's trying to do, it does it pretty well. I thought particularly the first third of this movie, first act, was pretty close to excellent. I really enjoyed how it set up all of the situation, how it kind of created a sense of tension. There are some sequences in the first part of the movie that are legitimately terrifying and well executed. There's a sequence in the fog on the side of a road that is absolutely haunting. It's really well done. And there's some stuff that's super creepy. I appreciated the fact that it didn't leap to super gore right away. It actually wanted to create some tension, and it actually cared about its story. It cared about its characters. It cared about investing you in the world and actually creeping you out and making you feel a spine tingle rather than merely a jump scare or a gross out. And I thought, you know, for what this movie is trying to do, it pretty much succeeded. I didn't feel it was overtly stupid. I think it falls apart as it gets closer to the end in sort of why people would be motivated to do a thing. But, you know, the central hook of this movie is old person fighting bad guy, right? It's grandma versus Mike Myers. And I find that to be a pretty fun premise, a pretty interesting take. And I thought it delivered on that in a pretty satisfying way. You know, I didn't think it was a great movie by any stretch, but I thought there were moments of pretty darn good. And overall, I didn't hate watching it. I thought it was if you're looking for something to get you into the Halloween spirit and you like a fun, creepy movie, I think you can do worse. I thought this was pretty good.
I would say it's a solidly executed slasher film. You know, it's yeah. if you like slasher films, I think you won't be disappointed with this one. And, you know, I talked about how I watched the first Halloween recently and I actually didn't share what I thought about it. But it's some of the direction in that film is pretty amazing. Like there are yeah. some shots that John Carpenter does in that film that to this day have not been equaled. You know what I mean? In terms yeah. of how brilliantly executed they are, how he uses shallow depth of field and blurs the like there's all this stuff going on in the background. Right. And the foreground is in focus. In the background, you see like Michael Myers doing random, crazy, creepy shit. And he uses that background and foreground kind of interplay really beautifully in that film. So like once Michael Myers shows up in the first film and like things pick up, I think it's a really well done film. You know, all the stuff before that with the relationship with Laurie and her friends, like I'm personally not as interested in that stuff. But there's just some great direction in the first Halloween, the 1978 film. And I think a lot of it is referenced really lovingly in this film. Like, I don't know. You said you hadn't seen the first film in a long time. But
yeah.
There's many shots that are a direct reference to the original Halloween.
I sensed that, which is why I kind of regretted not revisiting it before seeing this. And certainly, you know, the events are referenced and cast members come back. But I sensed that there was even more, and I'm sad that I didn't get that experience.
I think, like, I'll just list a couple, and I think this is – I'm going to be, like, very, very vague so as not to spoil anyone. But there is a shot when a character is in school, right? And then that character looks out a window and sees another character,
yeah, right?
Direct reference to the first film, right?
Right.
And there is a shot when a character looks over the side of a house and tries to see a character lying on the ground, but that character's right. not there anymore. Direct reference to the first film. And here's the thing. In the first film, that character that I'm talking about that is seen is Michael Myers.
Right.
But in the new film, it's not Michael Myers. It's a different right. character. And the way the film plays with that and kind of inverts who you think you're going to see is very clever. And I think it is more than just kind of a rehash. It kind of is in some ways quite inventive. So
yeah,
I enjoyed this movie. You know, it's not a movie. Like, I think there's some people I've seen on Twitter who like really love it. And they're like, oh, I went to go see this a third time. And I'm just like, I have absolutely no interest in seeing this movie again. You know, it's not a movie that – like, I guess I just – I find it – I just still find the concept of the character to be super uninteresting, you know? Mm. It's just a dude that can kill things. You have no access to this person's inner life.
Right.
He's got very little personality aside from the mask. And,
right. And the mask has no personality.
I think there's, like, people who are, like – freaking out, like screaming in their cars right now listening to this podcast being like, Dave Chen, you're a moron. But what I thought was absolutely comical was there is a character in this film who is a doctor, and another character actually identifies him as quote unquote the new Loomis, which is a reference right. to the character of Loomis, who is a big presence in the Halloween franchise.
Right.
And this character has, quote, studied, like, he's basically studied Michael Myers for 40 years. Michael Myers has been his obsession for 40 years, which I thought was pretty hilarious because apparently Michael Myers in that time has not said a single word. So what is he studying? Like, just studying how Michael Myers, like, walks around and, like,
stands in a corner.
Stands in a corner. You know, like, what? Yeah. What is he? And to me, that felt to me like there are people who are like love this franchise, and I don't see a there. You know, I don't see like aside from really awesome direction of slasher scenes, like really genuinely suspenseful, like really great jump scares. Like the technical craft is excellent in both the original film and this one, but beyond that, there's nothing for me to really be attached to emotionally.
It's even worse. There's literally the line from that doctor character who says, it's not that he can't talk. It's that he chooses not to.
Mm, yeah, that's correct.
Which, how do you determine that? How does
he physically has a mouth and lips and a tongue and stuff and can move them, right?
Sure. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can talk, you know?
Yeah.
How does he know that he chooses not to talk but is physically capable of it?
Mm.
He doesn't know that.
Yeah.
There's no way to know that.
Anyway. I think it was very clever how for much of the film I don't think this is a spoiler because this happened like early in the first scene of the film. But for a significant portion of the film, Michael Myers is not wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And they always figure out a way to keep that face just a little bit out of frame. You know?
You know how in the second Austin Powers movie?
Yes.
They start and he's naked.
Yeah.
And they do a elaborate series of props that always get in the way of his junk.
Yeah.
That's that, but this is for Michael Myers' face.
Yeah, agree completely. It's actually it's pretty amusing how they do it, actually. So, also, Casper Mattress in the chat room says that Carpenter's score in the original was fantastic, but the score of Halloween 2018 wasn't as good. I mean, I don't know how I feel about that statement. I thought the score in this film was actually pretty solid and a great follow-up to that original score. But also, that is one of the most iconic scores of all time, right?
Like, yes, it is.
You hear 3 seconds of that score, you know exactly what movie that is, what franchise that denotes. And so saying, like, it's not as good is like, okay, yeah, it's not as good as one of the best pieces of horror film music ever made in the history of cinema. Okay, congratulations. good observation. You know, like...
Yeah, way to go, Casper Mattress.
Yeah, thanks for that. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was a solid score. So I appreciated that. Okay.
I want to mention that I may have my take on this movie may have been slightly swayed by the fact that Jamie Lee Curtis, with the hairstyle that she sports in this movie, looks very much like my mom.
Mm.
Like shockingly like my mom. So I don't know. I was inclined maybe to be more invested than I may have watching my mom run from Michael Myers on the big screen.
All right, let's get to spoilers for Halloween starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
Well, Jeff Cannata, this weekend I saw a film that's a sequel to an older movie in which an unstoppable killing machine is defeated by an iconic heroine. However, in the sequel, it's clear that the initial trauma has had a lasting impact. The heroine from the first film has basically become a survivalist and has passed on her trauma and survivalist skills onto the next generation. It all culminates in a big confrontation where the heroine barely escapes with her family and the villain is consumed in a fiery blaze. The last shot of the film takes place on a road as the protagonists head into an uncertain future. But enough about Terminator 2, Jeff.
So good. That's one of the best ones you've done, Dave.
Let's talk about spoilers for Halloween. Boom goes dynamite.
So good.
Boom.
So good. Jamie Lee Curtis is definitely doing a Linda Hamilton in this movie. They don't even try to pretend that they're not just ripping off Terminator 2. It's egregious, but I think it's fun. It's still fun.
Well, this movie adds several things to the slasher genre, right? In my opinion, number one is this movie basically asks the question: what if slasher genre, but the victim is prepared, right?
Right.
And there's some really cool things that she does. Like, there's still like some stupid things that happen, like the dad leaving the house. You know, and
check on stuff. He's checking on stuff. You got to check. See, oh, is there something happening out here that's not the killer trying to kill me?
Like, nope, maybe set some ground rules. Like, don't fucking leave the house by yourself.
Yeah.
Given that we're under, you know.
Go ahead.
And then the second thing is just like this idea of trauma that the movie actually respects. Like, oh, hey, this one event,
yeah,
can actually shape your entire life, and certainly like. That not only can it shape your entire life, it can be passed on generation to generation,
right.
And that's certainly something like we've seen in the news recently of trauma making a big impact on people's lives and how that can play out. And so I think the movie does a pretty good job of respecting those things.
I thought that was pretty interesting and a cool take on that. I liked the ride that we go on with Jamie Lee Curtis. It's fun. I mean, we're telegraphing the idea that she's prepared, that she's going to be awesome. She's not quite as awesome as we're led to believe, I think. I mean, she's not exactly Linda Hamilton, I don't think. But I guess that's realistic, you know.
Why do you say that? Like, what about her makes you say that?
Well, she has a veritable arsenal in her home,
yeah.
And she chooses one weapon to walk around the house with. It's like her preparedness is disproportionate to her actions, in my opinion. Mm. And we, you know, ultimately the whole point was to get him down there to trap him, to burn him, but also like, did you need to lose every possession that you've ever had in the destruction? Like, do you have to burn your whole house down? I feel like there's a way to kill him that didn't involve you losing everything you own.
Well, according, there is some interesting commentary in the film about like how these two characters almost need each other in some way.
Yeah.
Right. Like that. There's a predator and the prey, and then like right. that the existence of the other in some way defines the other, you know, and that like
right.
and because of that, like basing your whole existence around this other person, it doesn't strike me as out of the realm of possibility that like, hey, I'm willing to consume all my earthly possessions for that thing, for this conflict. That being said, I believe it is a late change that that they burn him in the house. Like this may or may not be true, but like we saw someone tweet at Slash Film today that they saw like an early preview screening and the ending was completely different.
Oh, really?
It was a confrontation between Jamie Lee Curtis and Michael Myers, like, you know, like a knife fight of some kind. And you actually see a shot of it in a trailer, I think.
Mm.
So it seems like the burning in the fire might have been a late stage addition, which may or may not answer why it feels like not super well thought out to you.
Mm-hmm.
This is just conjecture. That being said, I do agree with you that like it does seem that some scenes are contrived to, you know, some scenes are contrived in terms of to generate suspense. Like she has these super cool doors that descend from the ceiling, like these metal blast doors, and like every time she like hits one of those and it comes down, it's like, oh man, like. If only every character in a slasher film had these, right?
Right.
But then it's like, well, why were they open in the first place?
Yeah.
Like, why?
Just start, like, as soon as he walks in the house, all of those go off.
Yeah, just close all those immediately, you know? Like,
yes.
So it's stuff like that that's like, okay, well, it feels like characters are making suboptimal decisions to generate tension, right?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I have a reading of the film that you may want to cut out of this episode eventually. But
oh no,
I think because we'll probably get very angry emails about it. But it occurred to me that there is a reading of this film that is absolute right-wing propaganda. that Halloween is a propaganda film for the extreme right wing. And you have a older white woman, let's call her, I don't know, a Fox News viewer, who has assembled a Fallout shelter-esque doomsday scenario bunker with as much Second Amendment paraphernalia as she can possibly muster. And she is on the run, or she is filled with terror of this other, this faceless other that on the outside looks like a white person, but who knows what's on – we'll never know what's on the inside. Might probably isn't white on the inside, is pretending.
I think he's white, actually. You see that he's white in the film.
I'm just saying that he's other. He doesn't say anything. He probably can't speak the language. He never says a word. He just comes after. He's around. He's terrifying.
Until saying Michael Myers wasn't white, but continue.
No, I'm saying that his faux face is white, but he's not. He may not be. What is he under there? We don't know. Just like all the other others out there. Okay. I
mean, his hands are white too. Okay. Anyway.
You're probably gonna have to cut this out.
Okay, Jeff. Here's what I'll say. I don't agree with you. Again, you lost me at the Michael Myers thing, but I do think that movies like this do propagate this idea of I think it's called like the cruel world theory or a cruel world perception. Right, the idea that like everyone's out to get you.
But
like,
I'm not done. So the doctor who represents learned people who know things and feels for this other, he's the only one in the movie that actually cares about the other. But of course, his caring leads him to sympathize and empower the other and make it even more deadly and release it from the police officer's cage and allow it to continue killing because he cares so much about it and you know, wants to study it and learn about it like all left-wing democratic a-holes. And in the end, the only way to destroy this other is to burn down your own house, is to destroy all the things that you hold sacred, is to vote against your self-interest, to do the thing that would actually hurt you the most, but at least the other is also being destroyed.
That's
Halloween 2018.
So as I said, I mean, I don't know about Michael Myers being the other. He's a white dude. You clearly see he's white in both the original film and this film, and he puts on a mask that makes him even more white. So that's where I think the analogy falls apart a little bit. Mm-hmm. Where I do agree with you, this is the idea that these movies, like I remember the movie Rambo, right? I think it was Rambo 4, basically the movie Rambo with Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, not and Rambo. Rambo.
I don't remember anything. Well, not First Blood. I don't remember anything about that film except for one scene, which is the idea that I think there's like peaceful missionaries that go to like try to convince Rambo like, hey, like, dude, you know, it's OK to be nice and loving and peaceful. And then like the missionary guy at the end ends up like killing a dude because he's like the only adequate response against violence is more violence. Like the only way to protect yourself is more violence. Mm-hmm. And like he kind of freaks out, and like the movie ends up validating Rambo's point of view that like basically you need to be good at killing to survive in this world. And there's many, many movies where, like, think about Taken, which is like a very popular franchise, where this like older character is really, really scared about what's going to happen to his daughter, and all of his fears are completely validated in the most spectacular way. Like the worst thing imaginable happens to his daughter when she goes on this trip. And so the lesson of that movie is she never should have gone to this other country, you know, like
listen to your dad.
Yeah. Listen to your dad. You know, listen to your dad when he's being super overprotected, you know. Yeah. And in this movie, Judy Greer, who actually for a change is given something to do. So that's great. compared to like when she's usually in like three scenes in a movie and then you never hear from her again. She's,
I mean,
an
she's
awesome
only
actor.
In three scenes in this movie as well, but
well, a few more than that. But I mean, she is portrayed to be naive. You know, she's portrayed to be not as with it as Jamie Lee Curtis's character, because Jamie Lee Curtis is the only one that actually knows what's going on. You know, right. And Judy Greer's character specifically says, like, no, Mom, the world is a loving place. You know, like, right. There's actually kindness and goodness in the world. Basically sounding a lot like Jeff Cannata.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
She
gets what's coming to her.
She's wrong. She's
people.
The one. She's the one that's wrong. She's the one that needs to pick up a gun and shoot Michael Myers in the head at the end.
That's right.
So
just like I do at some point eventually.
Right. Exactly. So I think I don't know if the movie is like an allegory for, you know, freaking Fox News or anything like that. But I do think that it does validate this worldview that it's every person for themselves and violence is the only answer to violence. Right. And this thing is just evil. And there's nothing to understand about this force. It's just evil. No point in trying to study it. No point in trying to sympathize. Right. All you have to do is destroy it with as much force as possible, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a very simplistic message that, you know, I don't know if I care for it. I don't know if I care for it, Jeff. So.
Yeah.
Couple things to just point out as we wrap up here. One is, like, what do you think of the Doctor character going insane? Like, the idea.
There was a moment where I thought, oh, is Michael Myers dead and this is the new Michael Myers? Is
right.
that where this movie's going?
Yeah.
I thought that would have been interesting, that it's this, you know, Dread Pirate Roberts kind of passing along. But I was super creepy that he put the mask on.
Yeah.
I thought that was really super
yeah,
creepy.
Yeah, is this going to be like 007? Like he's the new Michael Myers, you know?
Yeah.
And then like every movie is a new Michael Myers? Yeah.
Right. That was and the movie. Fact that Michael Myers then also kills him because you know, and the movie makes such a big deal about the fact that he doesn't say any words and then never pays that off. Never pays it off.
What do you mean by that? Like, you thought he would talk at some point?
Yeah. There's a moment where clearly they're looking at him. He's standing there. He's about to burn up. I thought, here it is. The one time he says a word.
I did not feel that way at all.
The setup was, all I want is to say a word. Just say any word. Just say a word. All I want you to do is say a word. And then, you know, she's like, oh, he said a word to me. And he's like, oh, I must know the word he said. It felt like all we need is Michael Myers to say a word. And the movie's like, nah, he's not going
to
say anything.
That did not occur to me at all. I think, like I said, it's reinforcing this idea that there's nothing to understand there. There's nothing complex there. It's just an evil force. And I think the movie, you know, that was the company line and it stuck with that. And that's fine. The subplot of the journalists at the beginning of the film.
The podcasters.
Like, it felt like it could have been a critique of podcasters or journalists basically profiting off of people's misery and suffering.
Sure, yeah.
Or sensationalized. Like, I mean, the dude is clearly unhinged, right? The journalist who's like has the mask and he's screaming at Michael Myers to say something.
Yeah.
That guy is insane. Like, that guy's, you know, not as insane as Michael Myers, but quite unbalanced, it seems to me. But
yeah.
And so it felt like the movie could have been a critique of that in some ways. But really, they're dispatched so quickly that I think that the journalists, the only reason they're there is to get Michael Myers' mask back, right?
Yeah.
And it feels like a pretty big missed opportunity to have something interesting to say on that front. Not saying the movie doesn't have other interesting things to say, but like that particular area was a waste.
So there's two moments I'd like to highlight. I mentioned already the moment in the fog on the side of the road with the crashed bus and the fact that we don't see the breakout. I love that we come to it later. It is so much more terrifying having just to see the aftermath and the chaos of that moment, especially through the eyes of that young child. But the fact that we see that child murdered, I was like, whoa,
ooh,
movie.
That's when you know the movie's like playing for keeps.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah.
And then that leads me to the second moment, which because of that setup, the moment where he goes in and kills that woman in her home and then walks through and you hear the baby crying.
Yeah.
I was like, he's going to kill that fucking baby. I was like, if he murders a baby in its crib, I might have to leave the theater.
Right.
Like, I don't know if I can take that. And thankfully, there's restraint. But I just thought that was a brilliant setup, payoff kind of moment of, I'm going to kill a kid and you're gonna watch this kid get smashed into the side of a bus, and that's gonna make you think that we're labeled to do anything here,
right?
You know? And I thought that was pretty deftly done.
Yeah, and it was. I thought it was kind of hilarious that it's like, oh, hey, even Michael Myers is not evil enough to kill the baby.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, he's going to kill the baby's caretaker, and the baby will probably starve to death at some point. But
yeah, the baby's going to be messed up and possibly dead either way. But at least we don't have to watch him like smash its brains or something.
Yeah. But on that note, there were a couple of like sequences of banter that I thought were actually genuinely funny. You know, like the banter between the kid and his – I think it was his dad in the car. And he's like, yeah. I'm really into dance class right now. You know, like
– well, the Danny McBride is a co-screenwriter of this movie. And there's definitely some Danny McBride DNA in it. You know, the two cops talking about
Bon Me,
sandwiches.
Yeah. I thought that was great. And I didn't even think it was a deconstruction of that trope. I just thought it was like a really solid version of it. You know, like it's just like – This is we're going to do banter, and it's going to be funny, and it's going to make you relate to these characters, and it's not quite like what you've seen before. And I thought that was delightful. So it was great to see that.
And the babysitting moment with the kid, you know, the kid that belongs in an 80s sitcom, you know,
right.
He's like Webster or Different Strokes, you know, he's like that of that mold of like one of those kids that's, you know, more street smart than his age, you know, would lead him to believe. He was very delightful and funny as well.
Last shot of the movie is a zoom in on the knife.
Yeah.
The Strode girl is holding. Did you have any interpretation of that? I think there's a couple possible interpretations. Some people have said like maybe she's going to be the next Michael Myers.
I don't think that.
I don't think so either.
I think yeah.
But I think there is a possible interpretation. I don't know that this is my interpretation, but I think it's possible to interpret that as like, well, to kind of reinforce a point I was making earlier, that like the only thing that could defeat this force is like the weapons that the force itself used, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But
no body, no death. We do not see Michael Myers
correct.
Consumed by fire. We see the fire surrounding him. We see him staring maniacally, you know, passively at them as the fire surrounds him and engulfs him. And then we see an external shot of the house exploding. We do not see Michael Myers. We do not see what you would expect, which is the mask melting on the ground or something like that. So
Jeff,
nobody.
I think it is adorable. Adorable that you think that even if we did see Michael Myers' body, that would mean he's dead. That is just so cute.
Good point. It's
that
good
is
point.
So cute.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this movie or shall we wrap it up?
I mean, ultimately, I think Michael Myers, we know him to be pushing 70 in this movie, 60-plus-year-old man who still is terrifying and gets hit by a car and walks it off and stabbed and shot multiple times and walks it off. He's just like this AARP member. That's all he is, right?
Yeah, I have a feeling there's going to be more Michael Myers, though. This movie made $77 million this weekend.
Yeah.
That's insane. It is going to be the most successful Halloween film of all time.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm a little baffled by it. Like, I don't understand what is it about this movie that so resonated with people. I mean, it's awesome that Jamie Lee Curtis is headlining a movie that made this much money. Like, she's awesome. And so,
she's awesome. And I think that there's something really that concept of the original person coming back
right.
and seeing, you know, grandma versus the Michael Myers. I think there's something fun about that. I think this just sort of hit at the right time. There aren't a lot of other horror movies competing for the October scare factor. People like going to horror movies in October, you know? So
if you look at the other reboots that have happened recently, like Nightmare on Elm Street, that came out in 2010, you know, that movie opened to 32 million. Friday the 13th in 2009 opened to 40 million. Now, you could argue that those movies are much worse, but I just thought, wow, yeah, I think it must have been that premise that really got people, I think.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we'll be seeing more of these movies. If you like them, all the power to you. If you think they're okay, you're probably more like me, and you could take them or leave them. All good, either way. But solid slasher movie, no complaints. That's
yeah,
our
I thought
view.
It was pretty good.
Yeah, that's our review of Halloween. All right. Stay tuned to hear what we'll probably be discussing next week. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from AdamWarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Sometimes we use a slash film court spoiler bumper or a slash film court bumper that comes from SimonMHarris.com. Jeff Cannata, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do a video game podcast called DLC, which you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC.
You can find all of my stuff at DaveChen.net. Subscribe to get my emails at DaveChen.net/letters. I try to recap all the stuff I've been reading and thinking about that week.
I like the idea that you would just like forward people your emails.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Get my emails. It's just spam that I get that I forward to you.
No, I actually really appreciate all the people who have subscribed and responded to that newsletter. Again, it's DaveChen.net/letters. Really appreciate it. And it is original things. It is not just things that people sent to me. So next week, I think we'll be reviewing The Old Man and the Gun. So that is what we have on store for next week.
Yeah.
We may try to do a BoJack Horseman season 5 review if we can get the talent to get that going. But yeah, that's what we got in store. Thanks for listening to the Slash Homecast as we continue to evolve this month with different co-hosts and different permutations. Appreciate your patience. Hope you're enjoying the show. And we'll see you guys later.